You know that music. You know it's not safe to go into the water. Jaws premiered 50 years ago this summer, and we're going to talk about it today. Therefore, you're going to need a bigger boat. I couldn't resist. I had to tell you that. I just had to say it. You're going to need a bigger boat became one of the iconic phrases associated not only with this movie, but with pop culture in general. In 1975, the summer of 1975, Time magazine pronounced it the summer of the shark. This movie, directed by 27-year-old Steven Spielberg, was the first summer blockbuster, and we're going to talk about it today. We would love to hear what you think this day, 50 years hence, from the premiere of Jaws. If you've seen it anytime within the last 50 years, let us know what you think. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. I'm Tom Hall. It is midday, and joining us from Martha's Vineyard, where Jaws was shot 50 years ago, Jed Dietz, the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. Hey, Jed, how you doing?
Great, Tom. Good to talk to you.
Good to have you as well, as always. And Anne Hornaday is with us, too. She's the film critic for The Washington Post and the author of Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies, which is now available in paperback. Hey, Anne.
Hello, Tom.
So, Jed, up in Martha's Vineyard this summer, the 50th anniversary of Jaws, I take it it has not gone without notice up there.
It is definitely not... not gone without notice, including a full Cape Symphony Orchestra presentation of the film doing the music. But people sprinkled all around the island wearing T-shirts with the hazardous beach sign on them. And it's a big event here.
Now, have they screened the movie, you know, umpteen times? I mean, are people actually watching the actual movie?
Oh, absolutely. The Cape Symphony was one of the presentations, but they're showing it in various locations around the island at various times with different people hosting that have been involved with the movie. Richard Dreyfuss was here for a while. So various people have come in. But of course, many people in the movie are actually people who live on the island, you know, who were recruited for the movie.
And I mean, this place this for us in cinematic history. This was it's the second movie that Steven Spielberg made, but it's the one that really put him on the map. But it really changed movie making kind of all around, didn't it?
It did. I mean, you know, we had had blockbusters. We had the Cecil B. DeMille extravaganzas and things like Cleopatra. You know, the 70s was famous for all those wonderful disaster movies. So it's not that it really invented the blockbuster form, but like you said in the intro, it definitely associated blockbusters with summer. And summertime became kind of its own business model, I suppose, in Hollywood. And of course, we have to remember that it was followed just a couple of years later by Star Wars, which, you know, was released around the same time. And so the two together, I think, and then Superman, which we'll be talking about the latest reboot in a few minutes. So that all kind of pushed Hollywood into this business model. And I've been kind of on a, you know, campaign in recent years to say that they took all the wrong lessons from Jaws, because when you, first of all, Jaws holds up so beautifully. I rewatch it every now and then, often for anniversary type things. And I'm struck all anew every time at the craft of it, the superb craftsmanship on every level. But, you know, the thing about Spielberg, not only is he just a compulsive entertainer and storyteller, but he's a humanist. And it's the human element. It's those three guys on that boat that make it so compelling. And I think that brought people back over and over again. There is spectacle, sure. And there are jump scares, sure. And the shark when he arrives is amazing, yes. But it's really the guys in the boat that make it a classic and that endure. And I wish that Hollywood had taken that more to heart than just the bells and whistles.
So true.
410-662-8780. What's your take on Steven Spielberg's Jaws. Midday at WIPR.org if you want to drop us a note. And Jed, he's 27 years old when he made this movie. What did he draw on? I mean, by that time, by 1975, there had been, I think, 15 Godzilla movies made already, 4 King Kong movies, lots of horror films. Creature from the Black Lagoon was, you know, 20 years prior to Jaws. Did he borrow heavily from, I don't know, Alfred Hitchcock or Roger Corman or anybody in particular?
Well, he certainly did. I mean, he had all those movies you listed, I'm sure Spielberg had seen. He's been watching movies since he was 8 years old, like a fiend. But I think Hitchcock was probably the one that influenced him the most, because they had horrible mechanical problems with the fish. They spent a lot of money getting a great designer to build them 3 sharks, huge 26-foot sharks, which were actually 10 feet bigger than the actual great white. But they didn't work in salt water. There was nothing. They did everything they could to anticipate the problem, but it didn't work. And it really forced Spielberg almost on a dime to rethink how to show the shark, how to use the models. And Hitchcock became a tremendous influence to him, because you remembered that Hitchcock, could scare the daylights out of you by suggestion, because he knew your own mind would scare you more than just blood spurting all over the place. And Spielberg was able to do both things. I mean, the opening shot, there's a wonderful documentary released today, I think, on National Geographic, and then it will be available streaming, I guess, on Disney Plus, but called Jaws 50. And there are filmmaker after filmmaker after filmmaker talks about how great the opening of that movie is. And it's pure suggestion. It's kids on the beach. The light's not very, it's evening, so you don't see too much. And a couple breaks off to go swimming, and then she gets attacked by a shark. And you don't see anything of the shark, but it's a horrifying scene. And I have to throw in a little local thing from the vineyard. The jeweler on the vineyard, C.B. Stark, the woman's name was Chrissy, and her arm came off because of the shark and all this stuff. And they have copied 2 of the rings that were on her arm.
Oh, gee whiz. That's great. Well, and, you know, they did, you know, famously have problems, as Jed just mentioned, you know, with these mechanical sharks. They built 3 of them. One was a full size deal that you could shoot from either side. One was shot from the right, the other was shot from the left. But in fact, the shark doesn't make that many appearances in the movie, partially because they just couldn't get it to work very consistently. Right. So Spielberg had to kind of work around that. But in a way, I guess film historians have said it makes it all the more intimidating. As Jed said, you know, it's in your mind instead of on the screen.
Absolutely. And I just think I agree with Jed about the Nat Geo documentary. It's outstanding. I recommend it highly. And one thing that I think the documentary really demonstrates and honors is the work of the team. You know, it's the cinematography team just did amazing camera work on that boat, really difficult conditions to film. And the great Verna Fields, the editor, I mean, so much of this movie, when you're working with that kind of material and you have those limitations, it really does come together in the editing. And it's all about kind of creating interesting cuts and juxtapositions and that suggestion that Jed was talking about. You do all that through editing. So it's, it's such a great example of how filmmaking is the function of a singular vision and leadership, which is the director, but then it's just the consummate collaborative medium. And so it's such a great, a shining example of both things. And I just can't say enough about it.
Ann Hornaday is the film critic for The Washington Post. Jed Dietz is the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. I'm Tom Hall. I do nothing worthwhile. And I am the host of Midday, and it is Midday at the Movies today. You can let us know what you think of Jaws or any other movie for that matter. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. Let's go to the phones to Michael, who's on the line from Hampstead. Welcome.
Hey, how's it going? Hey, Tom and Jan and Ann. How you doing?
We're doing great.
Hello.
So you've when's the first time you saw Jaws? I'm assuming you've seen it more than once.
Well, yes. And what happened was in the summer of 74, when it rained back then, we didn't have a lot of stuff to play around with. And we'd hang out in my friend's two-car garage. His mom got Reader's Digest condensed books. And I actually read Jaws the summer of 74. I thought, this would make a great movie. Well, the next year it came out. And our church youth group would go to North Bethany every year, and they left the day school ended that Friday. The Friday that Jaws opened, we passed the Aspen Hill Twin, where it was backed up. We get to Ocean, North Bethany, and our leaders had tickets to see Jaws opening night that Friday at the Sun and Surf Theater at Ocean City. So we saw the movie, and nobody wanted to go in the water.
Exactly. That wrecked the vacation awesome. for the rest of the time. Well, thanks, Michael. I appreciate the call. We're having a little trouble with your phone line, so we're going to let you go. But, you know, Jed, it's interesting. There were sequels to Jaws. Evidently, Spielberg was asked to do the second one, and he turned that down, but somebody else did it. They did a second and a third one, I guess. But as a franchise, I guess this wasn't particularly successful. It's really only the original movie that really, you know, has made its cultural mark. This is not like a Marvel franchise or something. What do you think happened? I mean, it was so successful the first time. Why couldn't they replicate that?
Well, I think it's what Anne's been pointing out, which is this team led by the great Steven Spielberg. We didn't know yet whether he thought he was ending his career during the shoot of Jaws at the young age of 27. But of course, it launched it, and it's because of what Ann said. There's a sequence in the film that gets talked about a lot. That is very quiet little sequence, and it's Robert Shaw and Richard Dreyfuss sitting at a table in the boat, and Robert Shaw goes into the story of a true story of the battleship, the Indianapolis, World War II. And it you see his hatred of sharks and what happened to the sailors when that boat went down in Pacific waters. And that came deep into the shooting. It came out of Dreyfuss and Shaw had not gotten along very well. They were sort of going back and forth. Shaw was very difficult, drinking a lot and stuff like that during the show. And this came out of a idea, and it was like a 25-page monologue that's been written by, I think, Carl Gottlieb, who's one of the writers on the show. And Steven showed it to Shaw. He read it and he said, this is fantastic, but nobody's going to pay any attention to this much monologue. Give me overnight and I'll do it for you. And he said, I need a drink though. I need to have a little, I'm supposed to be drunk in the scene and I just need a drink. And Spielberg said he made this horrible mistake and said, go ahead. And he didn't perform well that night. And he called Spielberg, woke him up at night, and he said, I hope I haven't embarrassed you and ruined. He said, I screwed up and I'll do it again tomorrow. And he did it. The thing we see in the movie is the one he did the next day. And it's brilliant. He had cut down the huge monologue, and it is you just see what a great actor. And Dreyfuss is very much, it's what Anne said about the editing too, as he's listening to the story, that little story gets delivered in a phenomenal way. And I don't think even Spielberg is just going to repeat stuff like that. I mean, I just think everybody sort of hit that note. And of course, that's what happens in great art. And I think Spielberg understood it and said, let's move on. And he had the biggest box office in all of history until Star Wars came out from his friend George Lucas.
The next one, right. It was the first, Jaws was the first film to gross more than $100 million in North America. And so far, it's earned about $478 million over the years. We have an email.
I tell you one quick little story. Jeff Voorhees is alive today, but played the little boy who was killed on the raft. And he begs his mother to go back in the water, gets killed on the raft. There's a whole story about filming that scene, which is interesting. He's still getting residual checks from it because he had to join the Screen Actors Guild.
Wow. Awesome. Talk about a good move there. All right. We have an email from Catherine who says, I'm a great admirer of Spielberg, but I have to note that the film demonizes sharks in an extreme way. It's helpful to remember that we humans are swimming in their habitat, and we should respect that.
Well, I want to tell you something. I talked to Wendy Benchley, Peter Benchley's wife, and he has since died. But she has spent her whole life working with shark, trying to save sharks because they've been really slaughtered, mostly by Asian cultures for shark fin soup and stuff like that. And she said a very interesting thing. She said the movie just scared everybody, and just go kill sharks was sort of the attitude for a few months. And she said all the membership of her foundation and a lot of these things started going up after that. And she said the movies actually had a tremendous impact on saving sharks.
Yeah, interesting. And to talk about a cultural imprint, it's not just, the techniques involved in the movies. It's not just the fact that they made so much money, but it really changed culturally the conversation about sharks and their natural habitat, et cetera. That must be one of the metrics for a movie's, cultural imprint.
Yeah.
For sure. And again, that documentary gets into that in a really interesting way. They mentioned this documentary that had come out even before Jaws called Blue Water, White Death, which for some unholy reason, my parents decided was a great idea to take the family to. I just talk about trauma. I mean, that just blew my young mind and scared the,
I bet,
jeebies out of me. But those scientists, the scientists that had been doing Blue Water, White Death, also worked on Jaws, and they're part of that whole conservation movement as well. And so that's, yeah, you're right. I mean, I think that the caller is correct that it probably did stigmatize sharks unfairly. But to the degree that it inflamed people's passions and maybe, increased their interest, like Jed just said, then maybe
certainly
it's all
did
to
that.
The good.
Yeah.
I hope so.
Let's slip in one more call before we take a break. Let's go to Deborah on the line in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday at the Movies.
Hey there. I was 8 when Jaws came out, and I was at the Walden Composers Camp through Peabody in Vermont. And it was the 70s, so people just carted little kids around with them and didn't give a second thought to it. So I went and saw Jaws with with my camp counselor, who was 19, and I couldn't stop laughing. I for some reason, I thought the film was hysterical. And I just cried and laughed until my ribs hurt, which made him cry and laugh until his ribs hurt. And it's still one of my favorite moments from that year. And I do still feel weird when my feet are dangling in deep water. I definitely hear that music in my head.
Yeah.
But in the moment, watching the movie, and I revisited it later, and I was like, wait, that shark doesn't even look real. Like, I kind of understood why I started laughing.
That's right. And, the two notes that changed the history of film scoring. I mean, if you want to play it, go find a piano and find the two notes. There's two sets of notes that don't have a black key in between them, two white keys. One is B and C, so if you can find middle C, the one before that is a B. So go up three notes to the E and the F and just play boop, 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 and impress all your friends that you're playing John Williams. Great score. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll come back and we'll talk about some other movies that are currently in theaters with Ann Hornaday of the Washington Post and Jed Dietz of the Maryland Film Festival. You can tell us what you're going to be screening this weekend, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, Ashley Sterner will be the guest host, and she will host a discussion about clean, emissions-free energy. Maryland's push for sustainable sources of electricity is between a rock and a hard place. The mega bill passed by the Congress last week cuts billions of federal spending on solar, wind, and other clean energy projects around the country. But meanwhile, at the state level, Governor Wes Moore angered advocates by vetoing several initiatives related to climate change. So Ashley will speak with Clean Energy Insiders, and she'll have a status update on the controversial MPRP power line that's been proposed to cut across three Maryland counties. So Ashley will bring you that conversation tomorrow on Midday. And if you just joined us today, it's Midday at the Movies. Ann Hornaday is the film critic for The Washington Post and the author of Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies, which is now available in paperback. Jed Dietz is the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. And you can join us. Email is midday@wypr.org. Phone number 410-662-8780. So, Ann, let's talk first about a movie called Life of Chuck. We have a little clip. This is a life-affirming, genre-bending story, I'm told, about three chapters in the life of an ordinary guy named Charles Krantz.
The world loves dancers. It truly does. But it needs accountants. So there's much more demand, so there's much more opportunity. I know that might hurt, but it's the truth. Math is truth. It won't lie to you. It doesn't factor in your preferences. It's pure that way. Math can do a lot of things. Math can be art. But it can't lie. So, take another run at those two, because Chucko, you are good. You have art in you.
There you go, Ann. He's got art in him. How about the movie? Does it have art in it? It's playing at the Charles and the Landmark Theaters, by the way.
It does. I was really taken by this film. It's by a guy named Mike Flanagan, who attended Towson University. He actually delivered the commencement address at my own daughter's graduation last year and gave one of the best... It was one of the best commencement speeches I've ever heard, hands down. It was just absolutely brilliant and charming. He made his name by doing horror series for Netflix, Fall of the House of Usher and Haunted Hill House and things like, which isn't my bag. So he was really not that known to me. And then did this movie. It's based on a Stephen King short story. It won the Audience Award at Toronto last year, which is a really... You know, it often will lead to Oscars. I'm not sure it will in this case, but it clearly indicates a movie that connects with people. And it very much does. You won't believe who plays. That's the main character's uncle, Albie. And I don't know if I want to spoil it in terms of to tell you who plays him, because he's unrecognizable in the role. Tom Hiddleston plays Chuck. It's metaphysical. It's thoughtful. It's sweet. It's funny. It's kind of indescribable. You know, it is genre bending that way. But yeah, it's just, I thought it was just a really special, singular movie.
Cool. Jed, what's your quick take?
Well, I agree with what Ann just said. And she warned me, so I won't give away who plays Uncle Albie. But it's almost worth seeing it just for that and to see Hiddleston dance. There's a sequence. It's a guy trying to come to terms with the idea that the world is tough, a tough place to live, and maybe because of things we're doing to it also, and stuff like, you know, those kinds of issues are swirling around this. And there's this moment of spontaneous joy that comes through him and a drummer who's on the street, just setting up drums and drumming. And it's got moments like that. Mike Flanagan, I don't know whether Anne remembers it, because she certainly was covering the festival for The Sun from the very beginning. But Mike Flanagan's first movie was at the festival. It was called Make Believe. He was a student at Towson, taking a class from Steve Yeager, one of our audience members, I presume. And it was a joy. And it was not horror. I mean, he's sort of those early movies, like a lot of filmmakers, is sort of like he pushes them to the side, I think, just because he was trying things and not fully developed yet. But it was a hit at the festival. And Megan Anderson, the terrific actress at Everyman, came out of it. She was also a student. And this thing it's just so interesting that he chose it. It's a very difficult piece, and it's full of great people.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Let's talk about another one, Ann. What's your take on Materialists? This is about a matchmaker in New York who finds herself, in conflict by a director and writer named Celine Song. It's also at the Charles Theater. It's also down in Harbor East and at the Regal Theater. What's your take on that one?
You know, this is the follow-up to Celine Song's breakthrough film a couple of years ago called Past Lives, of which I was a huge fan.
Yeah, I love that movie.
I think this is a little bit more of an awkward, it's an ambitious movie, even though it's sort of another small canvas. Dakota Johnson plays this modern-day matchmaker for people of means who want to get off the apps and have a more bespoke matchmaking experience. And she is involved in a triangle of her own, the hypotenuses of which are Pedro Pascal and Chris Evans. And I think what Song is trying to tackle here, and I really admire the effort, is just the issues, the thorny issues of class and money and looks and insecurity. And I mean, just some of these third rails that people often won't talk about or don't want to talk about when they're talking about love and what they're looking for in love. And she really addresses it head on. I'm not sure that and I think some parts of the movie work better than others, but I really admire, she's kind of taking Jane Austen on and kind of, going her one better, in terms of confronting the realities beneath romance. And I thought the three actors did a great job of creating chemistry. And I will say, this movie's one of the movies this summer that's really hanging in. I mean, it opened a while ago, and it is just chugging along, which is another sign that it's connecting with audiences and connecting with people, which is always great to see.
Yeah, it is. In our last few minutes, Jed, I want to get your take on a movie called Sorry Baby, which doesn't open this weekend, but next weekend. We have a little clip from Sorry Baby. It's directed and written and stars Eva Victor.
We know what you're going through. We are women.
What?
I know you're scared, but you're okay.
There are some ways people treat you like you're a person who lives and breathes and thinks for themselves. And then some ways people treat you are not that way. I can feel in my body that it was really bad. But there's a reason, even if I can't see it, that I'm alive.
Sorry, Baby. So, Jed, what's your quick take on this one?
Well, it's a first-time movie, written and directed. It was at Sundance and got a lot of notice there. I think it's an interesting attempt, but has got some of that first time movie making, and I'm looking forward to it. I hope she makes more movies. That's all.
And before we go, I want to ask you about Superman. That's going to be, I guess, the attempt at the big summer blockbuster this year. It's at the Regal and Cinemark theaters. What can you tell us about Superman? Worth going or not?
Well, this is... I'm not going to be able to give a soundbite on this because I think the actual filmmaking is so all over the place. It's James Gunn, who did Guardians of the Galaxy and Suicide Squad, and he's trying to do a lot in this movie. He's trying to rescue it from the seriousness that it got mired in recent years. He's trying to reintroduce, you know, introduce a new Superman, which is played by David Corn Sweat very well, I might add, and a whole new cast playing these iconic characters. And he's setting up other movies. So there is, it's very busy. And to my mind, it was too busy and too chaotic and just too much. Now, on the plus side, though, I really do think this actor and Rachel Brosnahan plays Lois Lane. You know, they do a fine job. And by the end of the film, I think it kind of found its groove, or maybe I just found it myself and eased into it. And, you know, I look forward to seeing more of them in these roles. I'm of the belief that that superhero fatigue is really settled in. I'm skeptical about how many more stories we can possibly see. You know, they just are all starting to feel the same. But I do think that the lightness is welcome, the new actors are welcome, and we'll see what comes next.
All right, Anne Hornaday is the film critic for the Washington Post. Her book is called Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies. It's now available in paperback. Thanks, Anne. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Jed Dietz is the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. Jed, always good to talk to you, and enjoy the rest of your time on Martha's Vineyard.
I will. Thanks. It was fun being here.
And up next, Midday theater critic J. Wynn Russick and Mark Horowitz will join me to talk about the collection of manuscripts and drafts of the work of Stephen Sondheim, which is now housed at the Library of Congress and available for public viewing. We'll talk about it after a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.